910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. New details about former President Trump's alleged behavior on January 6th coming from the special counsel's probe. The most vivid description coming from Trump's longtime employee and former deputy chief of staff for communications, Dan Scavino. ABC chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl says advisors came to see how Trump was acting while the attack was unfolding,
all urging him to make some kind of statement telling his supporters to leave the Capitol. The sources say Scavino described Trump as non-responsive and his demeanor as, quote, very unsettling.
ABC chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl. The FAA ordering a temporary grounding of Boeing 737 MAX 9s as the NTSB starts an investigation after a hole ripped open in the fuselage of an Alaska Airlines flight. A U.S. official says the White House didn't know about Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's hospitalization last week until after he had been in the hospital for 3 days. This is ABC News. It is time for one of the biggest cultural events of the year in the Big Easy. ABC's Brian Clark has more.
Carnival season in New Orleans is officially underway. It all leads up to Fat Tuesday, and for local residents like Peggy Scott Laborde,
we treasure each day, and this is an early carnival, so we just have to pack more energy and more activities in.
It's good news for those who rely on the tourism dollar, as Mardi Gras was impacted by the pandemic, but experts say it's rebounded strongly. This year's season starts early, but also ends early. Fat Tuesday is February 13th. Brian Clark, ABC News.
A health scare in Philadelphia. Officials announcing a cluster of measles cases in the city among unvaccinated residents. The city health department saying there are now 6 locations in Philadelphia where people may have been exposed to measles since late December. As of Friday, there were 6 confirmed cases and 3 presumed cases of measles reported. Barbie leading the pack with a whopping 9 nominations at tonight's Golden Globe Awards. I'm Dave Packer, ABC News.
Her name is Pam Jahnke, but you can just call the host of the Midwest Farm Report the Fabulous Farm Babe.
That's right, and the Fabulous Farm Babe is now part of the Civic Media team on your local station, Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM in Hayward. Here's show host Todd Alba with the announcement.
She is a broadcast legend. Doesn't matter whether you're a farm person, ag person, a producer, or just a good old Wisconsinite or a Packer fan. Pam Jahnke, welcome to Civic Media.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Yeah, lifelong Wisconsinite. I grew up on a small dairy farm in northeast Wisconsin, O'Connell County. Stop and think about the work being done 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to make sure that you and I are the best fed in the world.
Join the Fabulous Farm Babe Pam Jahnke on the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM in Hayward.
Your Midwest Farm Report, weekdays from 5 until 6 AM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. 25 states are raising their minimum wage this year, but not Wisconsin, where baseline pay remains at $7.25 an hour. Mike Moan spoke with an expert who says that leaves some workers behind.
Labor economist Laura Dresser has studied the issue for the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. It says even though employers are increasingly offering higher wages in a tight labor market, competitive pay isn't reaching everyone.
So the $7.25 really matters, but it's less binding today than it was in the past. But for the workers who really have those constraints on opportunity because of their concerns about immigration status, concerns about physical mobility, employers can really take advantage of that.
She says that makes it especially hard when there's more pressure from inflation. Her findings show that raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2028 would boost pay for nearly 15% of Wisconsin workers. Skeptics of such moves argue about hurting businesses, but Dresser says research on California's higher level found no measurable impact on jobs. Dresser notes that supporting a higher minimum wage is not necessarily a political issue, with increases seen in both conservative and left-leaning states. She points out that in those states, it's not just the workers who are benefiting.
You can also see that in state economies where they've raised the minimum wage, that there's actually a payoff that employers are receiving, because while they've raised the wage, they're also reducing costs associated with turnover and open positions that they can't fill.
She says the higher wage helps the employee with things like transportation and childcare, making it easier for them to stay in their job. Dresser's research also notes that black and brown workers and women stand the most to gain when there's a minimum wage boost. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio, refreshed.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Any morning flurries ending, we'll see clouds around the area, highs in the mid and upper 20s with a northwest breeze. Tonight, those clouds stay put. Lows will drop to the lower teens. A few flurries Monday afternoon with highs near the 30-degree mark. Some light snow Monday night. It's 21 at our studios.
Rice Lake's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome back to this, the second hour of our discussion of all things related to the rule of law, the administration of justice in America, in Wisconsin, and throughout the world. Thank you for joining me this morning. As always, taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Also inviting you to go on the Civic Media website, pull up the app and send us your question, your inquiry through that process as well. My wonderful producers this morning, Johnny and Anya, will get those comments and questions to me, and we will take them on the air. We're going to continue as we go forward with our discussion, not only about this major news having to do with the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, making the decision to review the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court, keeping Donald Trump off the primary ballot there in the state of Colorado. Decision to grant certiorari and review that case coming up for oral argument in a little bit more than a month from right now, presumably an expedited decision by the Supreme Court sometime shortly after that on a variety of different issues. The Supreme Court has opened up the issues to the parties to discuss with the Supreme Court whatever they choose to challenge, whatever they choose to say to the Supreme Court has not defined more narrowly, as it sometimes does, cases that it has before it. And so we will be anticipating not only the filing of briefs, but also that oral argument in a month from now, and certainly a fascinating decision coming up by the United States Supreme Court, presumably sometime in late February or early March, about whether or not Donald Trump remains on the ballot in Colorado. As we said in our first hour, also some consequences depending upon what the Supreme Court does. It upholds that decision. What about the collateral consequences, collaterally stopping future states from litigating this issue based upon its resolution there in Colorado? All of that unknown, untested, unprecedented, a word we use a lot in the past, and we're going to be using it a lot in 2024 going ahead. In this hour, we're going to discuss, again, not only those related issues, but also do some inventory of the other cases, the other matters, civil and criminal, pending in our state and federal courts. And then, as always, taking your questions and comments. And in that connection, we've got more callers. We're going to take them right now. Mark from Sussex, you've been on the phone for a while. Delighted to have you with me this morning.
I appreciate you taking my call. I just have a very simple question. Why hasn't Donald Trump been charged with anything to do with an insurrection?
And it is a good question. So here is my legal take on that, if you will, Mark. It's a great question. Plainly, prosecutors, including Jack Smith, have a great discretion when it comes to deciding how, under what circumstances, to charge particular cases. We know, and I suspect it comes from your knowledge, Mark, as well, that Jack Smith has made the determination that he would charge Donald Trump with four counts a violation of federal law, including this charge under Section 1512, which is obstruction of proceedings. The other two charges related to deprivations of your civil rights, my civil rights, when it comes to deprivation of voting. Now, to your good question, Mark, it is not a specific allegation of insurrection. You could charge that under a number of different statutes in the federal code. Significantly, it's also not invoking many other possibilities for charges here. My own sense, and again, the only person who really knows the specific answer to your question is Jack Smith and his team. Presumably the Attorney General does as well. Probably the likely reason for doing this is to focus on a case that is most readily chargeable and provable in court. Not to say that it could not be proven in court in a criminal proceeding that Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection, but identifying, as prosecutors often do, the case, I don't want to say it's the easiest case, that's not the situation, but the case that's most readily provable and does not get involved in many other, even more technically complex and factually complex issues. My guess is, having read that indictment we talked about on this broadcast, Mark, many, many weeks and now months ago, he's narrowly describing the conduct here. A conviction on any of those counts that he has charged, again, you're right, they're not insurrection counts. They're charges of other criminal activity also under the federal code. Those will also carry a federal conviction, and the sentencing for those can be as strong and as lengthy as it would under other charges, including insurrection. Now, Fannie Willis, as you know, is also charged in a state system. She has come pretty close in her RICO charges, racketeer influenced and corrupt organization charges there, this sweeping indictment against many, many people, including Donald Trump, including many others there. She has also charged lots and lots of activity there, depending upon how you interpret those particular charges. They do not fall within the ambit of insurrection. Again, a decision that she has made to go kind of in the opposite direction from Jack Smith, to charge things very, very broadly. If she gets some convictions as a result of the charges in that case pending in Fulton County, likewise, under the state system, any one of those criminal charges, if they result in a conviction, could be sentenced under Georgia law, receiving the maximum penalty there as well. The upshot, Mark, your great question is, we don't know for certain, but an awful lot of this depends upon the discretion of the particular prosecutor and a strategic decision made upon the ways in which the case will be presented in court. A great question. History will tell us, and books will be written about this very time and the very question that you have raised. Appreciate very much your good question, Mark. Harry from Fond du Lac, appreciate your being with us this morning as well.
Thank you, Jim, for taking my call.
We'll take a next question here, and we'll go to Mark. Mark, you've been waiting on the line for a long period of time. Mark, your comment or question?
Fell, which appears throughout the Constitution, and that you cannot, and I guess in some cases the courts have said, well, it doesn't mean should in this particular case, but my point would be that under our Constitution, shall must remain the imperative command, because otherwise it's meaningless. Because then you could have cruel and unusual punishment, because, well, shall in that case, we just mean we should have no cruel or unusual punishment in this country, because we can use some flexibility in this word. Donald Trump failed to uphold his duties as president under the United States, under Section 3 of Article 2 of the Constitution, where part of his duties are to take care that all laws be faithfully executed. I mean, he didn't do that because he didn't ensure the peaceful transfer of power. When he lost the election, he refused to admit that he lost the election. He poisoned the public discourse by saying, "I lost. I was cheated." Even though repeated law court cases said, "No, you were not cheated." The investigator that he hired to say find fraud did not find the fraud that they were looking for. I mean, it's by the vagaries of our under our Constitution that we have the Electoral College, because if Donald Trump was, if our presidential elections were held simply as a simple majority of the American people, Donald Trump would not have been in office the first time, because he doesn't win the majority of the votes across the entire country. It's simply because of under our Constitution we have the Electoral College, and we had to accept it when Donald Trump won in 2016. Donald Trump failed in his duty to faithfully execute the law.
Right. And so Mark, I'm going to pull out of that some very important points about language, right? Not only in the practice of law, but in the administration of justice, words have meaning and words have significance. Your focus this morning on this notion of that the Constitution in many, many areas, including the oath of office, including the obligation upon our president, our chief executive, to ensure that the laws are properly, duly, and faithfully executed, that is a mandate. That's not a should type of situation or may, a discretionary issue for the chief executive undertake. That is one of those shall things that you're talking about. That kind of language interpreted all the time by courts, federal courts, state courts, and imposing upon our elected officials the obligations established by language. Also the comment, of course, about our Electoral College, that kind of thing, of plainly focused on the ways in which we select a president, a decision made a couple of centuries ago about how we do that. Maybe, Mark, your good comment goes to whether or not we should now in the early part of the 21st century begin to think about changing this to a straightforward popular vote. Again, as you well know, that requires not only passage in the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, but endorsement by a majority of the states, as does any amendment to the Constitution. That one would be very significant in the times of recent elections, where we've had many situations here where the popular winner of the electoral vote in a presidential election does not go on to win the Electoral College vote. That kind of thing, giving speed, giving force to the argument the Electoral College may, in fact, be outdated. Mark, appreciate your comments, as always. We've got more callers on the line this morning. Appreciate this very much and the good discussion we're having this morning. Let's go to Tom in West Ellis. Tom calling in. Thank you for your comment, your question, your inquiry.
Excellent. Thank you for taking my call. I have two kind of separate questions, and they're off a little from the main topic here, but one is, how is Judge Cannon still on the Trump case? Why has she not been petitioned to get off of that case, to get someone who's obviously much less biased on the whole trial? Also, the other one is, what do you think the odds are that when the Democrats take over the House next year, them expanding the Supreme Court to make that less biased?
Okay, so two very good questions there, Tom. Appreciate your calling in with both of them. Let's talk a little bit about Judge Cannon. She is the federal judge in Florida. This is not the case involving insurrection. This is involving the documents case, right? This is the one charging that Donald Trump illegally held on to dozens of highly classified national security documents after he left office, conspired with two of his aides to obstruct the government's efforts to retrieve them. Last year, Judge Cannon expressed concern that her trial might collide with some of these other matters, and she has indicated that she's going to discuss all this on March 1. In between now and then, still, as you indicated, Tom, some interest in having her recuse herself. When we come back after this break, I'll comment on that a bit more, the likelihood that that may or may not happen, and then also the issue of expanding the Supreme Court. What has to happen there and what the Constitution says about that happening in the future. Stay with us for that further discussion.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZ.
America is kept safe because the Army National Guard responds, protects, and supports our nation when it needs them most. The Army National Guard responds to disasters such as wildfires and floods. They protect us with missile defense, cybersecurity, and civilian support teams for chemical, biological, and radiological hazards. Be there for your community and your country. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
I was proud to be a soldier.
I told the truth and got kicked out.
And so I thought to myself, I'm taking this rule down.
If you're an LGBTQ plus veteran, your memories are important too. Share your story with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, where firsthand accounts from U.S. military veterans are preserved and made accessible for researchers and future generations. Visit loc.gov/vets to submit your stories, photographs, and documents today.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back here in our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again for joining me for our discussion as we acknowledge today the events of January 6th of 2021, 3 years since that time, talking this morning a lot about the litigation, both criminal and civil, that's happened in the wake of those horrific events in our nation's history. And right before the break, Tom called in with a couple of excellent questions about Judge Eileen Cannon. She is once again presiding over the so-called documents case. This is a federal criminal case against both Donald Trump and two other defendants, alleging once again mishandling of classified and non-classified documents, though that allegedly in violation of federal law. That case also being prosecuted by Jack Smith, the special counsel. The judge has indicated in that case that she's going to have a hearing on March 1, a couple of months from now. Between now and then, not a lot going on there. She has set a trial date of May 20th. In that particular case, and we'll have to wait to see whether or not that sticks, given all the things that have got to happen between now and the time of a trial. But that's where the case is status right now in terms of the docket and Judge Eileen Cannon. Tom's question is, why is she still on the case? There is plainly a process by which judges can and should recuse themselves in the right circumstances. Jack Smith has not specifically requested that. He has plainly expressed great frustration with her diplomatically and appropriately in court and out of court, but has not expressly asked her to recuse herself, nor has the Department of Justice more generally done that. That kind of thing, especially in the wake of her decisions in this matter, basically trying to stop the investigation of this case when it was in its investigative stages. All of those matters, the 11th Circuit at the time, determining that Judge Cannon had wildly overstepped her bounds in restricting what the government can and cannot do, basically turning back virtually all the things that she did in civil cases that were being prosecuted by the Trump team before the criminal case went ahead. All of that giving rise to Tom's concern, I suspect others as well, about her bias. We will see what happens down the road. That trial, again, scheduled right now for May 20th. And other proceedings to happen between now and then. Tom's other question, very good question. Again, it's a process question. It's a civics question. It's a constitutional question. So we love to talk about those things here on our broadcast. It has to do with expanding the numbers of Supreme Court justices. We know in the Constitution that the tenure of Supreme Court justices is established at life. That applies also to appellate court judges and district court judges as well. That's by virtue of the language that James Madison wrote into our Constitution that says that judges will keep their tenure during times of good behavior. Good behavior. That's been interpreted to mean federal district court judges, appellate judges, Supreme Court justices. Once they're confirmed by the Senate after being nominated by the president, once they're in office, they stay there until they either resign, they die in office, they decide to retire. They could be impeached. We've had one of those impeachment proceedings, but not removal. All of those things, again, set forth in the Constitution. The Constitution does not, to Tom's very good question, prescribe a specific number of justices, and it's been as low as five, been proposed to be as high as 11 and 13. It has wavered during the course of our nation's history, stayed at nine since the late 19th century. But the answer, Tom, to your very good question is that Congress, which does have a lot of authority when it comes to how the Supreme Court operates and how it functions, even if it doesn't make decisions for the Supreme Court, the Congress is the one that could make a determination to increase frankly, to decrease also the size of the Supreme Court. Obviously, the president early on commissioned this group of people to look at that issue and came back with some recommendations about the positives and the negatives of doing that. Doesn't appear that that's going to happen anytime soon, but that's the process question. Numbers of justices can be changed legislatively. Tenures of justices can only be changed by a constitutional revision. Tom, thank you very much for that important and thoughtful question here in our morning broadcast. Peter from Merton also calling in this morning. Peter, glad to have you with your comment or your question for our consumption this morning.
Okay, I have two things to say. First, on the issue of if somebody can be a write-in on a Wisconsin ballot, that has to be approved ahead of time. So if someone isn't approved ahead of time and people write them in, those votes don't count. So you can check that with the commission, if you will. The other thing is, definitely, if this Supreme Court doesn't take Trump off the ballot because of the insurrection, then we know for sure that our Supreme Court is just another partisan Republican entity, if you will. And those are just my thoughts. So Peter, I'll let you respond to those.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much. Again, issues of write-in. Obviously, as your point indicates, I was indicating before, I don't know what the Colorado process is here. We know under the Constitution those kinds of things, to your very accurate point, Peter. The Constitution says the times, places, the circumstances of how voting takes place. Those are matters reserved for the states, including here in Wisconsin, Colorado, that sort of thing. So appreciate the civics note on that as well. Very well stated and pointed for our discussion this morning. Your other point about the United States Supreme Court, that is a part of the discussion that we have in America because we've got a First Amendment. And there's no doubt that with respect to whatever the Supreme Court does on this particular case, having to do with whether or not Donald Trump stays on the ballot in Colorado, whether it says yes, whether it says no, makes some determination in between all these issues I described before. Avenues for the Supreme Court to avoid the issue, to embrace the issue, to say yes to no, to do all kinds of things here. Whatever it does, plainly, is going to be the subject of additional commentary, Peter, of the sort that you've made. Others, obviously, out there in the public domain will be commenting upon this for not only years, but probably this case, again, Trump versus Anderson, going to be in the annals of the Supreme Court history in the same way that Bush versus Gore was there and other cases, obviously a huge case in the history of our Supreme Court. I appreciate very much, Peter, your comment on both of those issues, including your perspective on the participation of all of us in this process, commentary on what our Supreme Court does, what all of our courts do. It is a part of our life in America. What a good country we have that under our Constitution, we can speak publicly about those things, criticize government, and respond in a way that is consistent with our own views about how our government should work. Peter, thank you very much for that good comment and your question also along the way. Bill from Oconomowoc, also calling in this morning. Bill, appreciate your question or your inquiry as well.
Good morning, and thanks for what you do. You guys on the radio, you're just phenomenal. You're really a lighthouse in a sea of murkiness. But anyhow, as far as the Supreme Court goes with Trump, I don't like legislation from the bench, but this time we need it because this is something that has never crossed our country in the history of our country. So all eyes are on the Supreme Court. I truly believe they're not totally ignorant, that they know if they support Trump and protect him and allow him to get in, they're making a statement. If they make the right judgment and say, no, he's ineligible, we stand by the Constitution, we believe in all this, that'll happen. But you're closer to the action than we are. What is just your thoughts? Kind of like your point spread on a game. Give me your reaction, knowing what you know. What do you think will happen?
And Bill, I appreciate the comments and the questions. And you know what we're going to do? I'm going to take an answer to that. I'm going to offer an answer to that right after this break. Appreciate your good question of me about a prediction, my own crystal ball. Not perfect anywhere near that. But I'm going to take that up and answer your question right after this break.
I'm on the top of the world. And the only explanation.
Sawyer County's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. New details about former President Trump's alleged behavior on January 6th coming from the special counsel's probe. The most vivid description coming from Trump's longtime employee and former deputy chief of staff for communications, Dan Scavino. ABC chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl says advisors came to see how Trump was acting while the attack was unfolding.
All urging him to make some kind of statement telling his supporters to leave the Capitol. The sources say Scavino described Trump as non-responsive and his demeanor as, quote, very unsettling.
ABC chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl. The FAA ordering a temporary grounding of Boeing 737 MAX 9s as the NTSB starts an investigation after a hole ripped open in the fuselage of an Alaska Airlines flight. A U.S. official says the White House didn't know about Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's hospitalization last week until after he had been in the hospital for 3 days. This is ABC News.
The Badgers win. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, the Wisconsin Badgers paced themselves to an 88-72 win over Nebraska at the Kohl Center. Tyler Wall with 17 points for Wisconsin. Head coach Greg Gard says he was proud how the Badgers played the Cornhuskers on defense.
I thought we did a lot of good things. You know, and they hit some tough shots, and they hit 12 threes, you know, and I thought some of them, you know, they're a team that scored a lot of points, too. And the biggest thing with them was trying to minimize the attempts. I want them not to be able to get them off.
They'll take on Ohio State on Wednesday. Another loss on the road for number 7th ranked Marquette. They lost at Seton Hall 78-75. The Golden Eagles host Butler Wednesday night. UWM with a win over Detroit Mercy 84-61. NBA, the Bucks lose again, this time to the Houston Rockets 112-108. Giannis Antetokounmpo with 48 points, but a bad night for Damian Lillard, who had just 18. Milwaukee heading home now after this road trip. They host the Utah Jazz Monday. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Any morning flurries ending, we'll see clouds around the area, highs in the mid and upper 20s with a northwest breeze. Tonight, those clouds stay put. Lows will drop to the lower teens. A few flurries Monday afternoon with highs near the 30-degree mark. Some light snow Monday night. It's 21 at our studios.
America is kept safe because the Army National Guard responds, protects, and supports our nation when it needs them most. The Army National Guard responds to disasters such as wildfires and floods. They protect us with missile defense, cybersecurity, and civilian support teams for chemical, biological, and radiological hazards. Be there for your community and your country. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
Latrell spent more than 8 years in foster care. His world changed when he was adopted at 15 with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption.
I think about how much we love him, and I wish we could have had him for his entire childhood.
The foundation is changing the lives of thousands of teens waiting in foster care. You can help. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org. Latrell spent more than 8 years in foster care. His world changed when he was adopted at 15 with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption.
I think about how much we love him, and I wish we could have had him for his entire childhood.
The foundation is changing the lives of thousands of teens waiting in foster care. You can help. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org. Lexi spent more than 6 years in foster care.
Before I was adopted, I felt alone.
With help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, Lexi now has a forever family and the foundation for a bright future.
Adoption changed me for the better. I feel like I can be whoever I want to be.
You can help find permanent homes for children still lingering in foster care. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
From Birchwood to Poplar, this is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, your home for news, talk, and sports.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And we are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Delighted to have so many wonderful callers with questions, comments this morning. As always, 844-967-2789, or drop a comment into the Civic Media website, the app, and also be a part of our discussion. Right before the break, we had a wonderful question again from Bill, who was inviting me to speculate. I will tell you that in my practice, both criminal practice and civil practice, speculation is one of those things that judges do not permit in courtrooms, but this is the radio. And so we've got this wonderful opportunity, as I said before, under the First Amendment to chat about things and to speculate, because those speculations, if in fact they're at least somewhat well-grounded, can be interesting and maybe animating some of our movement forward. When it comes to answering the question, which we always ask is, what do we do about this? My own sense, Bill, and I have said this in some context previously, is that when it comes to this particular issue, that is the Colorado Supreme Court, the Supreme Court has many, many options out there. It can, again, affirm. It can reverse. It can also take some other off-ramps, procedural off-ramps, jurisdictional off-ramps. My sense is that the Supreme Court is going to find a way to keep Donald Trump on the ballot, not only in Colorado. If, in fact, Maine keeps him off the ballot based upon what the Secretary of State has done here, whether they're by implications of the collateral estoppel doctrine, which we also talked about, if other states do the same thing, my sense is that the Supreme Court is going to want to find that Donald Trump should remain on the ballots of the states in this nation, including Colorado. Now, I hasten to say that the best indication of whether going with this is going to be before all of us on February 8th, tune in for that oral argument to see where they're headed on this. And I say that in part not just because of the merits of the Colorado case. And again, the underlying order from the Colorado Supreme Court is compelling. If you read that particular order by the Supreme Court and you come to it from a reasonably objective viewpoint, it is exceptionally well done. It's based upon the law, the facts, and as we've said multiple times this morning, it's premised upon a trial, an actual trial, not a finding of an administrative agency, not a determination of a particular entity in our system, but it's based upon a trial and evidence presented. And the order that's now before the Supreme Court is just chock full of significant, meaningful, compelling positions that are articulated by the Supreme Court. So there's a substantive way of supporting what the Supreme Court in Colorado has done. The question, Bill, that I think you're asking is whether the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, will go down that route and do something else. My own very, very tepid prediction is that they will not, and that they will in some way find a way to overturn and reverse what the Colorado Supreme Court has done. Now, having said that, that plainly will be perceived as a win for Donald Trump and the advocates for him as a part of our process here. I also believe in another issue that we'll chat about now. We've talked about this before. The other issue coming up to the Supreme Court also is on immunity. The president has raised this issue in connection with the Jack Smith prosecution in the District of Columbia. Again, this case pending in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. Right now it's scheduled to go to trial in early March. She has suspended that date. While the issue of whether or not Donald Trump would be completely immune from prosecution is bandied about inside the federal courts. What's the status of that right now? Well, next week, Tuesday, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit is going to be entertaining argument from Donald Trump and from Jack Smith on whether or not an executive immunity for everything the president does while he, or maybe one day she, is in office, if every single action is immune from criminal prosecution. That is an extraordinary proposition. Basically, it would say that we have kings once again, as opposed to presidents. Indeed, Tanya Chutkan in her order said we don't have kings. We have people in the office of the president who are subject to the law of the land. In the case involving Nixon way back at the time of his resignation, Supreme Court said, yes, indeed, no one is above the law, including the president. It is impossible for me to imagine that the same Supreme Court that has said that way back when, admittedly composed of different justices today, is going to come forward and say, no, indeed, a president is completely immune from criminal prosecution for the things that that chief executive does while in office. That is a proposition that's simply untenable. And as I've said in other contexts, the kind of thing that opens up the door to the eventual destruction of a republic, because it undermines the entire concept of separation of powers, checks and balances, and this fundamental notion that we are all subject to the law in our nation. So my view is, to continue with Bill's invitation here to speculate, is that the Supreme Court's, when it ultimately gets a decision coming out of the Court of Appeals, when that case is appealed to the Supreme Court, whatever the decision of the Court of Appeals is, the Supreme Court is going to find, no, you are not immune. It's going to hand Donald Trump a loss on that case. He's going to lose that case having to do with immunity, anticipating as well that the Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia is likewise going to say you are not immune from prosecution. Jack Smith will win that one, to the extent we talk about wins and losses here. Donald Trump will and should lose that case. That, again, coming up for oral argument before the Court of Appeals, not the federal Supreme Court, but the Court of Appeals as soon as next week. And so we look forward to that one as well. A three-judge panel there is set to hear oral arguments on Tuesday. Interestingly, Donald Trump has indicated that he plans to attend that oral argument. That's not a trial. He'll not be testifying. But he has indicated he wants to attend that proceeding before the three-judge panel hearing this immunity appeal coming up as soon as next week. Again, another important issue. It should not be a close question for the appeals court or for the Supreme Court to resolve. Presidents are not immune from their criminal behavior during the course of their 10 years as president. And that's a position that plainly, has been a part of our jurisprudence for a very long time, should not be overturned by any court, including the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals. Now, all of that, of course, while that's pending, jeopardizes this trial date of early March that Judge Chutkan has set for the case involving insurrection, the insurrection trial, the federal insurrection trial, not charged that way, but again, the four-count indictment pending in the federal district court. She has basically suspended all those proceedings. And so the question is whether or not once the Supreme Court, once the Court of Appeals resolves that issue, at what time will the district court then actually take up the trial? Highly likely, going down this prediction road that I've been invited to pursue here, highly likely that the March date will not stay, and that Judge Chutkan will need to find another date. And that is no easy task. She will need plainly to identify a significant period of time for jury selection there in the District of Columbia, a significant amount of time, weeks probably, for the presentation of Jack Smith's trial in support of those four counts of the indictment, some alleging obstruction, others alleging civil rights violations in terms of the deprivation of the results of the election. That is going to take a long period of time. Presumably, there will be a defense as well. Interesting to see whether or not Donald Trump himself would testify in that case. He has got no obligation under the law, under our civics, under our Constitution, to testify at all. He is presumed innocent, as he is in the other criminal cases that are out there. No obligation whatsoever to put on any case, but can do so. And that could include his testimony if he chooses to do so in that proceeding. The upshot of all of this, that trial, whenever it is scheduled, is going to take months. And it is entirely possible that, again, assuming the Supreme Court, which I am going to assume, determines that he is not immune and that prosecution can go forward, that case may in fact be tried before November, but it's going to be right in the midst of the same time that we're the campaign of this summer, including a Republican convention in July right here in Wisconsin, a Democratic convention in Illinois just to the south of us, all of that taking place and plainly leading up to the election in November. The timing on all of this is going to make for a 2024 there's going to be roller coaster in many, many aspects as the interplay between all these pieces of litigation and the conduct of the campaign are happening at the same time. If that federal interference trial is postponed into the summer, maybe into the fall, there are indications that indeed another trial could take place. We haven't talked about this in a while. We recall well that Alan Bragg has brought this also criminal case against Donald Trump based upon hush money. This is based upon charges that Donald Trump took part in this hush money payment scheme to a porn star in the run-up to the 2016 election. If the New York trial were to go ahead, it could take place during the later stages of the primary season as Donald Trump, assuming his campaign does not falter, in other ways, goes ahead as the principal candidate here, prepares to formally accept the Republican nomination almost certainly in July in Milwaukee. That could happen. That could happen sometime this summer. That case, again, brought by the Manhattan District Attorney, again, his name is Alvin Bragg. It is involving this porn star. We know her name. She is Stormy Daniels. And it's alleged that Trump had an affair with her and sought to buy her silence as he ran for office in 2016. Then there's also Michael Cohen. We recall him. He's a so-called fixer, the lawyer for Donald Trump, also involved in that case. And he was the lawyer who basically negotiated that accomplished the payments between Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels to buy her silence. He would also be a witness for the prosecution. Again, this is the state prosecution by the DA in Manhattan against Donald Trump. Also possibly going ahead for trial this coming summer. We don't know. Alvin Bragg has said that he will defer to other cases. Well, if the federal case in D.C. Is not going ahead in the summertime, entirely likely that that case could move into that period of time. And then we've also talked about the other federal case pending in South Florida, that one involving Judge Eileen Cannon, scheduled right now to go on May 20th. Highly unlikely that will pass. We'll find out on March 1 whether or not the judge is going to stick with that trial. Highly unlikely that that will go forward in the trial setting of May 20th that she presently has scheduled. And there too, this issue of immunity. If indeed the president is immune for the things that he did during the course of his time in office, recall that some of the events related to the documents case also happened while Donald Trump was still in office. We saw those photographs and other allegations in the complaint, in the indictment, in the Mar-a-Lago case, alleging that he took them while he was still the president. Now, a lot of this has to do with post-presidential behavior, maintaining them, perhaps banning them about, using them for various purposes. We've talked a lot about that. A lot of things in the public domain about the ways in which those documents were misused, classified documents and other documents. But at least some of that also happening while the president was in office, while the former president was in office. And presumably, depending upon what the Supreme Court decides on the immunity issue, it could have an impact upon that case as well. Again, high level of predictability that he will not be found to be immune from that case or the Jack Smith prosecution that's coming out of the special counsel's office right now. And then there's some timing questions as well in Georgia. In Georgia, I mentioned before that Georgia also has, through the office of Fani Willis, who's the DA, she's the state DA. She is, if you will, kind of the counterpart to Alvin Bragg in New York, although charging a very different case. She has brought this omnibus RICO case against many, many defendants there. We know that four of them have already pled guilty, are presumably cooperating with the government there, the state government. May also be cooperating with other authorities, not beyond the realm of possibilities to think that people like Ken Chesbrough and Sidney Powell and others are discussing things with other federal authorities, other state authorities as well. That could also be happening. But right now, we know that in the Fulton County case, the prosecution has asked that trial begin as soon as August of this year. When we come back, I'll tell you about the likelihood that that will happen. And then we're also going to talk about a couple of other rule of law issues out there in the world when we continue with our discussion here on our Saturday morning broadcast. For only time will tell us so, and love may grow. We'll be right back.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZ.
America is kept safe because the Army National Guard responds, protects, and supports our nation when it needs them most. The Army National Guard responds to disasters such as wildfires and floods. They protect us with missile defense, cybersecurity, and civilian support teams for chemical, biological, and radiological hazards. Be there for your community and your country. Visit NationalGuard.com to learn more about part-time service. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at EasterSeals.com.
You're listening to the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
We are back on our Saturday morning broadcast talking about calendars, schedules in courts, and specifically talking now about the Georgia prosecution, the RICO prosecution against Donald Trump and many, many others in that case, indicating right before the break that Fannie Willis would like to have at least some of that case begin as soon as August. Highly unlikely the judge there will be embracing that particular scheduling order. We have not yet got confirmation from him about the timing on his docket for how that's going to go forward. Lots of things got to happen. Fannie Willis has also said that that case, in addition to all the other pretrial proceedings, is going to take months to try. And that's certainly the case. A great number of defendants, as I said before, charged entirely differently than the way that Jack Smith charged the singular defendant, Donald Trump, in the federal court in D.C. Fannie Willis charging, again, insurrection, interference with the Georgia vote counting and the Georgia election process, including in that indictment many, many defendants, some of whom have pled guilty already, many others presumably ready to go to trial at some point when a trial is set. That case, again, a very different kind of geography right now. Significantly, lots of things happening next week. Trump's lawyers have to file their pretrial motions challenging that indictment on Monday, just in a few days from now. That happening in Georgia. That's the deadline for the next pretrial proceeding there. And expect that Donald Trump there will also raise the issue of immunity, saying that the charges in Georgia echo the same allegations in Washington, D.C., and that he is immune from prosecution there. So that issue may come up again. And then in the interest of establishing our calendar, generally dates coming up, we return once again to New York and some things happening as soon as next week. Two other major cases continuing next week in the state of New York. In particular, we know about this major case involving the attorney general, who is now seeking $370 million in civil fines against Donald Trump for improperly, inaccurately, fraudulently valuing certain properties in the state of New York. She filed a brief just on Friday saying that in the wake of the trial, that is the amount of money the judge, according to the AG, should enter. Judge Engoron is going to be entertaining argument this coming week, oral argument again this coming week in the New York Manhattan State courtroom there. And lawyers on both sides will make their cases in that case about the amount of damages that Judge Engoron should enter in that case. And that, again, is Mr. Trump has indicated that he intends to attend those trial proceedings as well. We'll see if that happens. Again, all of that in a civil setting, not a criminal setting, but determining the future of the Trump Organization. It is, in addition to the criminal cases, a case of no small consequence. Huge consequence, not only for the monetary piece of this, but also the future of the Trump companies and corporation itself. The judge having already determined that it and some of its entities engaged in fraud. He made that determination a number of months ago. And this is now all about the remedies that follow in the wake of that finding of fraud. What amount of money should compensate the state of New York? What other things should be done to prevent this in the future, including restrictions, limitations on the Trump Corporation itself, whether it continues to exist in the state of New York, all of that in front of Judge Engoron. He has promised a decision in that civil case as soon as later this month, probably more likely in the wake of the oral argument, the written arguments coming in right now, probably in early February, and we will focus on that as well. And then also in New York, coming up in this month, is the damages trial in the case involving E. Jean Carroll. We have talked a lot about her as well. She's a New York writer who said that Donald Trump sexually assaulted her in this New York department store way back in the mid-1990s. A lot of litigation already, a multi-million dollar judgment already entered against him in the court. She is back in court this coming month. And Donald Trump has likewise said that he is going to be there for that as well. Maybe intending to testify, we don't know, has no obligation to do so. That, again, a civil trial. This is the second portion. This is the damages portion of another set of allegations brought by E. Jean Carroll involving the continuing defamation of E. Jean Carroll by Donald Trump. That matter, again, going ahead in a civil court in New York, again, as soon as the coming weeks here, as that matter proceeds forward, ultimately to disposition. I want to mention one other matter that also relates to this issue of immunity and something else that happened just this past week. And that is that there's also a case involving the death of Officer Sicknick. You may recall that at the time of the January 6th insurrection, Officer Brian Sicknick was attacked, and a day later he was killed. His partner has brought a civil action against Donald Trump and others for their involvement in inciting the riot that resulted in Officer Sicknick's death. Just this past week, the federal judge who's reviewing that case, presiding over it, has determined significantly in the context of our other discussions about immunity that Donald Trump does not have immunity in that civil prosecution being brought by the survivor. Her name is Sandra Garza. She's designated in Sicknick's will as his domestic partner and his executor of his estate. Filing this lawsuit in January of 2023 against Donald Trump and the two men who were found guilty in connection with the attack on the deceased officer, Brian Sicknick. The judge just this past week finding that Donald Trump is not immune and resolves that case very summarily. Again, consistent with my previous observations about the extent to which the Supreme Court can and should resolve the immunity issue generally very summarily. The judge in that particular case, and his name is Amit Mehta, we've talked about him before, in the District of Columbia in D.C., he said the court first addresses and quickly disposes of former President Trump's assertion of immunity from suit, dismisses that concept, and said, no, we're going ahead with that prosecution. Again, a significant case, another civil case being brought by a survivor of an officer who is the victim of the insurrection, a victim of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, which we observe and we recall with horror and with instruction about the future here on the third anniversary of that horrific event. Before we go, I'd also indicate that significant events coming out of Israel and also Chile. Israel, this past week, the Supreme Court there rejecting a prime minister-led move to limit the court. We'll talk more about that next week. And also Chile's voters recently rejecting a new constitution. Both of those cases involving the rule of law, which we continue to discuss every single Saturday morning here on our broadcast. I thank you for joining me this morning for our discussion about 2024, the cases pending, civil, criminal, and what we can expect as we go forward in the administration of justice, the focus on government, and the work toward due process, equal protection, the rule of law in the United States of America. Thank you for joining me this morning. Join with me again next week as we can resume this discussion. Take care, everybody.
Your hometown station for news, talk, and sports. This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. Be a part of the resistance. Check out The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson, Monday nights at 7 on the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, and on the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
This is the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM, W245CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app. ABC.